I'm a card-carrying proclamation evangelist. And in terms of what I enjoy most, you know, on a Sunday morning, seeing people put their hand in the air and say, I want to become a Christian, is one of the best bits of my job.
The Profile with Premier Christianity Magazine.
Hello, you're listening to Premier Christian Radio. I'm Sam Hales, editor of Premier Christianity. That's the UK's leading Christian magazine, published every month. Do check out our subscription offers available now at premierchristianity.com. Here on The Profile, we like to sit down with a different Christian every week and hear something of their life story. And I'm really pleased to say that our guest on the show this week is Phil Knox. Phil is an evangelism and missiology senior specialist at the Evangelical Alliance. He's also the author of a number of books, including Story Bearer, The Best of Friends, and most recently, Good News People, which is co-written with Gavin Calver, who heads up the Evangelical Alliance. Phil, welcome to the show.
Hey, Sam. So great to be with you today.
Great to have you on. I mentioned just then you've written this new book with Gavin Calver, who is both your friend and your boss. So what was that process like?
Yeah, it's great, isn't it? I think one of the great joys of ministry is that we get to do it with friends now and again. And I've known Gav for over 20 years. We met at a wedding when I was just finishing a law degree. We joke around that he ruined my promising legal career, because he persuaded me at this wedding, we'd never met before, to join Youth for Christ. I'd volunteered for Youth for Christ as a student, and the guy who was running the weekends away on which I volunteered was getting married. I met Gav, we had a conversation, I'd been praying about my future for a couple of weeks. It ruined my legal career, but since then we've had the joy of ministering together, both at Youth for Christ for 13 years and then latterly at the Evangelical Alliance.
That's great. Well, we're going to talk lots more about the book today. But before we get there, we always like to start at the beginning here on The Profile and go back to a person's early life growing up. So tell me a bit about what life was like for you growing up, something of your parents, and whether the Christian faith was there from an early point or not.
Yeah, so grew up in an amazing Christian family, was dragged to church ever since I was a fetus, and made a decision to follow Jesus when I was 6 years old. Really remember being at a Christian camp, someone telling me about Jesus. I was even more enthusiastic then than I am now, and I decided this was something I wanted to give my life to. Had amazing a Christian family, a younger brother and sister, mum and dad, teenage years. Had repeated moments where I kind of continually made my faith my own. But then the rubber really hit the road for me when I was 21 years old. I was at university studying law and got a phone call, changed my life completely, where a family friend calls. I'm having lunch with my mum at university, and a family friend calls and says, Phil, I'm really sorry, but this morning your dad has died. And these words ripped my world apart, to be honest, Sam. I recognise that now as a really key decision moment, because I could have easily said, God, stuff you for letting this happen. But actually, in a key moment in my faith journey, my story is that I kind of, as a family, we really depended on Jesus in that moment. And I don't know why loads of stuff happens. And if you're listening to this and you've been through bereavement, grief, or far worse than me, don't know where God is in that often. But I know that the Bible's promises that he's close to the brokenhearted. And that was my experience. So that was my dad. And then really sadly, during COVID, my mum died of cancer. And so kind of key part of my journey really has been the loss of my parents, but also the beautiful thing of growing up within a Christian family with parents who beautifully demonstrated to me what the Christian faith is all about. My dad was senior partner of a law firm, yet chose to live in one of the poorest communities in Birmingham. And that was a really key moment for us as a family in terms of the kind of cost of the Christian faith. And my wife and I feel similarly called to the same community where my parents gave their lives and ministries to. And so, yeah, feel the blessing of growing up in a Christian family. But also it's been through the battles as well as the blessings that my journey has been defined, really.
Yeah. And that's so often the case when you speak to people who have those moments of suffering, it tends to often push people in one direction or the other. And we can probably all think of people who have walked away from their faith because of immense periods of grief and suffering. But I can also think of many people like yourself where somehow your faith was deepened and strengthened through all that. Can you speak a bit more about how you and your family wrestled with your grief and why it didn't lead to the end of faith?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of factors, really. I think there was something about God's presence in those moments. I think also my parents really brought me up on the beauty of the good news. And so I really remember, for example, I was in Sheffield where I was at university, and we drove down the M1 back home with my mum. So my mum has just lost her husband of 25 years. I'm driving her home. And I just remember almost on repeat the words of the hymn, "Before the throne of God above, because the sinless Saviour died, my sinful soul is counted free." And in that moment, I think that kind of, I grew up in a home so rooted in the gospel. You know, my parents were part of the Navigators. So scripture memory is something Navigators are really into. We grew up on memorising Bible verses. So we'd get in the car on the way to school, my dad and I, and he would make me learn Bible verses before we could talk about the football. Which meant I learned Bible verses really quickly because I really wanted to talk about football with my dad. And again, in some of those moments, I didn't know at the time why I learned them. But 20 years down the line, when I think of suffering, I think of the verse I learned from Lamentations, for example. Lamentations 3:23, "Because the Lord's great love, we're not consumed, for his compassions never fail. They are new every morning, great is your faithfulness." Learning that with my dad at 13 helped me get through the death of my dad at 21. So that's the first thing. The second thing is, the church was amazing. I think I experienced community at its best during both the death of my mum and my dad. So my mum during 2020, when social distancing was in place, I really needed people. But we were so loved. So our kitchen looked like a florist, our living room like Clinton's Cards. We didn't cook for about 3 months because people just kept bringing food to the door. And I think both those things really reinforced how good the good news is. And when the rubber really hits the road, that's when you experience both hopefully the goodness of people, but certainly the goodness of God in those difficult times.
Yeah. And you also mentioned that your dad and your family could have afforded to live in a nicer part of town and chose to be in a more economically deprived area. And I think you said you've sort of continued in that vein. Tell me more about that thinking. You know, it's been said before that in the West now we can become incredibly comfortable. We have the means of sort of protecting ourselves from anything a bit edgy or a bit different or a bit difficult. And there's something in the Christian life of sometimes just choosing the hard path or the Jesus way, which is different, is less comfortable, less economically beneficial perhaps. Is that the motivation for living somewhere where it might be a bit tougher in some ways? What's it been like?
I think ultimately for my parents, certainly, and I hope for my wife and I, it's about fundamentally about obedience. And I think, you know, the quiet times that my mum and dad brought me up to have every day, in those times, God occasionally speaks to us about really big life decisions. And as I remember my parents' journey, it was a very clear call of God that this is where we were going to live. And these were the people we were going to be called to. And so I'm not sure about my theology of God calling to place. I think far more, actually, God calls people to people. And we were called to be part of this church that a book has been written about called Angels on the Walls, which was a church kind of under serious kind of oppression with a criminal gang meeting outside it in the 1980s. My parents were called to support the vicar and his wife in that journey. And we feel similarly called in that. So I think to a large extent, it's about obedience and listening to God and doing that. But I think there is also, throughout scripture, I see God's bias towards the poor. And I see, and my experience is that comfort is an enemy of growth and the Christian faith. And if I think of the ways actually as a middle-aged person, the devil doesn't quite try to trap me up in the same way in which he did when I was in my 20s. You know, in my 20s, there were just different temptations. Now I don't stay up late enough to be tempted in some of those ways. You know, a wild night in the Knox household is watching the 10 o'clock news. Do you know what I mean? Whereas now, as a kind of middle-aged person, my temptations are much more around financial comfort, social comfort, physical comfort, my pension. That's the way the enemy's going to get me. And I think for us, in especially in the kind of comfortable Western nations, we've just got to be aware of the way in which we might become more passionate about our patio or our house extension than about the call of God on our lives.
Yes, it's a challenging message. So tell me more about what church looks like for you, because I guess you're in quite a unique situation, both you and your co-author Gavin Calver. You're kind of in a different church every week because of what you do, work for the Evangelical Alliance, traveling, but then you're also someone who believes in local church. Is that a bit of a tension?
Yeah, it's not attention. It's a blessing, actually, Sam, because I couldn't do what I do without having been rooted in a church like where I am for the last 40 years. So actually, the fact that I'm so relationally rooted and so community rooted means that I've probably got the freedom to be able to do what I do, preaching all over the country. So we do church every day almost, it feels like, because our mission is our doorstep. We've got friends who live all around us. You know, my deepest relationship, friendship wise, is with my best mate, and we are highly accountable to one another, and we meet weekly to ask each other the difficult questions. It would be really challenging if the Lord called us now to go and, you know, move 100 miles away and start in a new local church community. I might have to take probably 6 months to a year off preaching, possibly, to be able to become relationally rooted again, so that that can act as, or could act as a launch pad to go and do what I do. And so I will often go on a Sunday night to a different service where I am, and that works for me. We were part of a kind of house group of friends meeting regularly to talk about the Bible. I'm just someone who works Sundays in some ways, but that gives me the opportunity to go and preach in a different church almost every week. I feel profoundly called to be a Barnabas to the church, to encourage Christians to go for it and live for Jesus and be good news people to those around them, but also to leaders. You know, some of my most valuable conversations are with leaders over lunch after church on a Sunday across the breadth of the evangelical world in terms of denominations, background, stream, stories. And that I could only be true to that calling, I think, of being so rooted relationally and being, I'm part of the leadership team here of the church where I am in Birmingham. Yeah.
I'd love to dig more into that idea of relationship, because I suppose friendship has become something of a specialist subject for you. You've written books on the topic, you speak regularly on the topic, and I think more than that, it just seems to be a bit of a cultural resurgence more generally of interest in friendship. I think there's been an acknowledgement that a lot of people in the West are quite lonely, and many of us live quite lonely lives. Why do you think it is that kind of forming and keeping friends is such a challenge for so many people in the West today? And how do you think the Christian faith can offer some answers in that area?
Yeah, I mean, you say being an expert in friendship, do you know, that is a double-edged sword, Sam, to be honest. With my own friends, you know, if I ever get something wrong or don't turn up to a party, they kind of say, Phil, you're meant to be good at this stuff. You write the books on it. It's a terrible conundrum to be in it. But you're absolutely right. It is one of the needs of the hour, I think. And I think you asked why we're living in a loneliness epidemic. I mean, first of all, let me give you some terrifying stats. You know, 1 in 3 men say they have no close friends. It's not much better for women. 40% of young adults, by the way, the most connected generation in history, say they always often feel lonely. The World Health Organization announced that we are living in a global epidemic of loneliness. Why do I think that is? I mean, I think we're really busy, first of all. I think that's one thing. I think another thing is we've neglected friendship at the cost of romantic relationship. So we don't talk about it in life or in the church. Our music videos and our TV programs, culturally, we are wired towards romance rather than friendship. We are moving around loads more. So lots of people are moving regularly for work. And statistically, if you live for more than 30 minutes away from a friend, you're way less likely to keep in contact with them. If you know you're moving on within 5 years, you're way less likely to get involved in something locally. And I think the other thing is, I think we're culturally as well in a really interesting moment where, I don't know about you, but my news feed is so polarized at the moment. And there's this narrative that you can't be friends with people you disagree with. And it's going to be very difficult, if that's the case, to find people who you agree with absolutely everything on. The reason the church is such good news in this regard is that church is just about the only place I go that brings together people from all different backgrounds, streams, stories, ideologies, political ideas, ages. And we're united around Jesus. And my prayer around this friendship thing is it's the antidote to a divided and broken world. And so that's one of the reasons I've become really passionate about it. But I think there's implications for discipleship, for evangelism, for leadership, intergenerational, intercultural church. If we can raise the volume on the friendship conversation and model something better, amazing things, I think, can happen for the good news.
I was thinking the same thing about the number of different ways you can apply this thinking, because you're right, discipleship, kind of one-to-one mentoring friendship, there's huge implications. There's implication when it comes to sharing our faith. It's been called friendship evangelism, this idea that you get to know somebody, you become friends with them, and it's actually a lot easier to share the gospel with a friend than it is a stranger, one could argue. So there's a lot of different applications for Christians when it comes to friendship. Do you get the sense that you're making progress in this area, that actually more and more people are talking about it? This is recognized as a thing we need to get better at, both as a culture and as the church. And the conversation is just flowing in a way now that it kind of wasn't 5 or 10 years ago.
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, first of all, I'm not the only one kind of fighting the good fight in this area. There's lots of other people. And for me, this journey started during the pandemic, where I remember profoundly I was on a prayer walk around my community, actually at a really low point. For me, kind of emotionally, actually, during the pandemic, but that rhythm of prayer walking around my community really helped. And I could point you to the spot where I was when I felt the Lord say, I want you to start writing and talking about friendship. And since that moment, that was probably 2022, since that moment, undoubtedly, the volume of the conversation has been raised in the church. And I hope the church is actually leading the way in some of this stuff. Really encouragingly, other people have begun to write on it. Mostly in the States, but also here. But when I was writing the book, I could hardly find any other person writing around the subject. Not just as a result of me, but I hope I've made an impact. Lots of churches have started preaching on it. I get lots of leaders come back to me who have run the Best of Friends in small groups. We've done a video series with Right Now Media, which has been used in loads of different places. And I think you're identifying of the implications for evangelism and discipleship. I think of one conversation with a church leader who said it's had a fundamental impact on lots of different areas of church life. And my hope is that it's not just a one-off, but actually for lots of churches, we begin to create cultures in which, I think it's Nikki Gumbel who says that people come to church for many reasons, but they stay because of one relationship. And actually in this divided, lonely world in which we live, friendship plays an increasing role in people coming to faith, going deeper, but also lasting the course.
Yeah. You mentioned the statistics are particularly bad for men. And I certainly have learned a thing or two about friendship from watching the example of my wife. If she knows a friend's going through a hard time this coming Wednesday, then she'll actually put a note, like a reminder on her phone, to text that friend on Wednesday, because she knows that she might forget. But she's being deliberate. She's being intentional about, I want to keep this friendship going, so I'm going to make a note to text that person on this day at this time, which is something I can honestly say, Phil, I've never done in my entire life. Do you have other tips like that? You think it's just a little thing, but something quite practical like that can be quite revolutionary, I think, in terms of how we prioritize our friendships and how we think that way. Because I honestly think a lot of blokes like me, we just don't think like that.
I'm making a value judgment of you, Sam, in this moment, but I'm guessing a bit like me, you're a bit of a doom scroller. And so for me, I'm a kind of constant scroll. If you're watching this on video, scrolling down the news feeds, I've got a little kind of trigger in me that I try to kind of enact I picture a kind of, you know, a meter of social media feed. And I kind of, in my head, I have this rule where for every meter of social media feed, I will text a friend to just check in and say, if they're a Christian, what can I pray for you? If they're not, just checking in and saying, how you doing? I found that quite a nice little rule of thumb. Often, I don't know about you, sat in various different places, whether you're on public transport or wherever you are. That's not a bad little kind of trigger for me. So there you go. That's what one little thing that I try to do.
I like it. It's a great little practical tip. Less doom scrolling, more texting actual real friends.
Come on.
Rather than scrolling past news feeds and people you disagree with politically. That sounds a lot more healthy. Very good. Thank you, Phil. Okay, well, we're going to move on now. And before we get to the new book, I wanted to ask a bit more about you and your journey and how you got to where you are. So you mentioned grew up in a Christian family, worked for YFC, now work for the Evangelical Alliance. But I wonder if I'd met you when you were 12 years old and I'd said, Phil, what do you want to do when you grow up? What would you have said? And what was the path that you were on initially?
Yeah, I was going to be a lawyer, Sam. I'm basically from a family of lawyers and evangelists. And so my dad, as I said, was senior partner of a law firm. He had a huge impact really on the social housing world, where he would often do big stock transfers of housing from local government to housing association, and was one of the pioneers of the kind of tenant-led community associations where tenants have a say in terms of their own communities. And he both lived that where we lived, but also wanted to see that make a difference across the UK. And so that was immensely inspiring to me. So I kind of, as I said, went to university to do a law degree. But to be honest, I think I see in my 12-year-old self the evangelistic DNA that I now see embodied in my work, because I think I've always wanted people to come to know Jesus. And I got every single lad in my class when I was at junior school to come to church or boys brigade or youth group, apart from one. And Richard Clarkson, if you're listening to this and you've become a Christian, please encourage me by telling me that you finally made it. But I remember being really upset the day Richard Clarkson left school, and I was like, what did I get wrong? And then my dad saying, that's what you're doing isn't normal. So I recognize in me a kind of from that age, a really deep desire to see people come to faith. I ran my first Alpha course when I was 13 in my school. It was chaos, but it was great fun. And kind of, so I see that in me. But I think if you'd have said to me, certainly as a student, I'd be working for a Christian organization, I wouldn't have believed you and probably have been horrified, because I think there was something in me also as an evangelist that didn't really like Christians, because I thought they were a bit safe and a bit odd, and I wanted to be out there in the world, and was probably had these delusions of grandeur that I was a bit cool, and so didn't really have many Christian friends at university, because I thought I'm going to be out there in the world in the football team trying to reach people for Jesus. And so that was a bit of the journey. And so with great surprise really, and a bit of Gavin's fault, joining Youth for Christ once I finished university was a big step. And then I probably initially thought I'd do it for a few years and then go back and do something else. But I just almost got addicted to seeing young people becoming Christians and thought, this is something I can probably give my life to. And here I am 20 years later with a different story to one in the legal profession. For the record, I think I'd be a terrible lawyer, so God knew what he was doing.
Hi, it's Sam Hales, editor of Premier Christianity magazine. I'm proud to say we are celebrating our 60th anniversary. From our beginnings as Buzz in the 1960s to the vibrant multi-platform magazine we are today, our commitment to connecting faith with the world around us has never changed. To mark the occasion, we have a special offer of 12 months for half price. That's just £24 for print and digital access. Subscribe today at premierchristianity.com. Automatically renews at £47.99. And how much of the kind of role that you do is about telling people directly about Jesus? And how much of it is equipping the church to be evangelists? Is it like 50-50? Is it all of it all at once? Like, what does that look like?
95% probably helping the church, 5% evangelistic preaching.
That's really interesting, because you said you kind of became addicted in a really healthy way to seeing people become Christians. But actually, most of your role is helping the church do the evangelism rather than you personally. So there must be immense fulfillment in just helping Christians share their faith better, as well as you continuing to do it, I suppose.
Yeah, and missiologically, I think most people come to faith through someone other than a full-time Christian. And so I am a card-carrying proclamation evangelist. And in terms of what I enjoy most, you know, on a Sunday morning, seeing people put their hand in the air and say, I want to become a Christian, is one of the best bits of my job, if not the best bit of my job. But I recognize that the gospel spreads at the speed of relationship. And so one of the best things we can do as evangelists is equip and inspire Christians to share their faith with their friends. So the recent Finding Jesus research that asked almost 300 adult Christians who've become Christians as adults in the last 5 years, who was the most important person on that journey? Church leader was 23%. Above church leader was a person from church, not the leader, a close friend, and a small group of Christians. And then just below church leader was a family member. So if our friends, neighbours, colleagues, family members are going to come to faith, it's not probably going to be through preachers like me or church leaders. And so a key role that I feel as a Barnabas and as what God's called me to do is to equip and inspire the whole church. First of all, to know that, but to live out the Christian faith in a way that draws people to Jesus, and to be able to tell their story and invite people to take the next step on the journey.
Absolutely. Well, that brings us very neatly onto the new book. It's called Good News People, Hopeful Evangelicals Yesterday, Today and Tomorrow's, published by IVP. You've written it, Phil, with Gavin Calver, who heads up the Evangelical Alliance. And I guess the book's doing a number of things. It's looking specifically at who evangelicals are. And then it's really looking at what the job is that we have to do and some of the challenges and opportunities ahead of us. I mean, it struck me that this is... there hasn't really been a book like this in quite some time. A sort of big picture setting out for evangelicals in the UK, this is where we're at and this is where we're going. Was that the kind of vision for this book?
Yeah, it had a curious origin story, Sam. Basically came, if you can recall the first page of the book, it came from me and Gav preaching all over the place on Sundays and texting each other from a lonely service station, having collapsed on the sofa after we got back home and going, how'd it go today, mate? And what we realised, again, if you were to scroll back to the scrolling thing, if you were to scroll back through our text message conversation from the last 5-7 years, you just see story after story and superlative after superlative that God's doing something amazing. And so Gav Cheesley said recently that it was really kind of the Bible Society and others to do a load of research to reinforce what we've been seeing for a really long time. And so that's not the case at all. But it is a celebration of the amazing UK church. You know, if the big bits of research like the Quiet Revival say what's happening, 2 million more people in church than there were 6 years ago, etc. We're telling a bit of the story of how it's happening. And we had no idea that we would be in such a positive, hopeful moment when we wrote the book. So that's kind of where the book came from. It's also an attempt to redeem the word evangelical, partly because we've seen such extraordinary growth in EA membership over the last few years. We want to give people a celebration and a kind of a positive view of what it is to be an evangelical. But as you also identify, it's the postures for now. How do we hold ourselves in these extraordinary times? And basically, we just believe the need of the hour is to stand firm on the gospel and go for it in reaching out and living and telling the story of the good news God that we serve.
I imagine I don't know who if anyone ever asked you the question, what is an evangelical? I mean, is that a sort of inter-Christian debate where Christians sort of say, oh, what does this mean? Or, you know, is anyone outside the church, do they even care? I don't know. But who does ask you that question, what is an evangelical? And what's the answer that you give?
Great. So it's a good, yeah, not many people outside the church, I don't think. But interestingly, I had lunch with a pastor on Friday of quite a large church in Birmingham. And he was saying he was at a wedding and a non-Christian said to him, well, what type of Christian are you? And he was like, I don't really know. So he kind of eventually kind of narrowed it down. He said, well, you know, I guess one of the boxes we would put ourselves in is as an evangelical. And so the person said, what does that mean? And so in response to that question, and I certainly do get asked, when you work for the Evangelical Alliance, people do ask you that question, Sam. But I think for me, we would say a few things. First of all, we base defining evangelicalism on a quadrilateral four things from a guy called Bebbington, who says that evangelicals are bibliocentric. So we don't change the word of God to accommodate our culture. We want to see our culture transformed by the word of God. Secondly, we're Christocentric, so we're Jesus people. We believe that the life and death and resurrection of Jesus was the most important moment in the whole of human history. Thirdly, we're conversionist, so we believe in the decision-making. You don't become a Christian by being born into a Christian family like I was or somehow by accident or by osmosis. The most important decision any of us can ever make is to choose to follow Jesus or not. And fourthly, evangelicals are activists. That's why it was the evangelicals who are at the forefront of the abolition of the slave trade. More recently, look at the big organisations across the UK, Christians Against Poverty, food banks, street pastors, whatever we can do to see hope come to the hopeless in our world. Those are the four things with which we kind of define evangelicalism by. But then there's also something I think beautiful about being part of the Evangelical Alliance, where it's almost a stream of streams. So actually, to be an evangelical is to recognise that not one denomination or stream can do it by themselves, but actually there's lots of expressions of evangelicalism that can make a difference across the UK together. And that's why the unity piece is so important to us.
In the book, you outline kind of where we're going and some of the postures that we need to have. It'd be great to dig into a few of those. I was very struck by... a phrase that I think you at the Evangelical Alliance have been using for a number of years now about being braver and kinder. Do you want to unpack that idea a bit more, and why you think that's so important for Christians to be hearing right now, that we need to be more brave and more kind?
Yeah, I think the postures, in fact, it's in the second half of the book, we hold these, all the postures are kind of, they feel like tensions that we've got to hold. Sometimes you meet really brave Christians who are just a bit shouty and a bit aggressive with their faith, but actually could be a bit kinder. And sometimes we can be so kind, we never tell the truth. And so one of the postures that we want to hold is that this kind of this tension between the two. And so we frame it both in terms of standing firm on truth, but also in reaching out. And so there's something about being brave in terms of when society says, actually, that view is pretty unpalatable. But where we say, actually, the Bible seems to be saying that, we need to be brave on holding on to biblical truth in that regard. But also there's something about the good news and sharing the good news in which we need to be brave in kind of reaching out. And so I tell the story in the book that last Easter, I felt that God encouraged me to go and knock on the doors around this community and give out Easter eggs and offer to pray for people on the doorstep. And to be honest, I didn't really want to do that, Sam, to be honest. I said back to the Lord, "Lord, I work for you all year round. Can I not have Easter off?" And felt the Lord's rebuke, was obedient, and got the response was extraordinary. But that took great bravery. So that's the kind of bravery piece. But then the kindness as well in both those things. Gav often says of the Evangelical Alliance, he would never want a complaint of saying one of us as a staff member are being unkind in the way in which we communicate stuff. And the Evangelical Church in the past has certainly got it wrong when it's been said we want to be right so much that we communicate that in an unkind way. And so we want to let our kind to be known for our kindness. But also in terms of the way in which we reach out, I think it was deliberate that the Lord said to me, go and hand out an Easter egg, as well as offering to pray for people, because there's something winsome about the generosity and hospitality of the church. And I hope that in years to come, when people say, what's an evangelical like, that bravery and kindness is something they talk about.
I think it's a real challenge for Christians in general, let alone evangelicals, to be known as kind. But one pushback on what you've just said, Phil, might be something like, well, I as a Christian have a different view on sexuality, on same-sex weddings, let's say, to the majority of the population. I read my Bible and I don't think same-sex weddings should be allowed in churches, for example. And this person might say, it doesn't matter how kindly, how gently I express that point of view, I will be shouted down as a bigot. So yes, of course we should be kind, but really it's a losing battle and I'm just going to be hated because I follow the Bible. What would be your response to that?
I think that I would hope that the friendship piece that we've just talked about wins in that scenario. And so I've got lots of friends of all different backgrounds and opinions. And I remember being on holiday with a couple who we've been friends with since our university days. And we were talking about all kinds of things, politics and that issue of same-sex marriage, and kind of said, well, actually, we've got a difference of opinion here. And I said across the dinner, bear in mind, we've got 3 days the holiday left. So this was a bit of an important question. I said, guys, we disagree on this. I said, can we still be friends? And I kind of waited with bated breath thinking, are we going to have to find different sun loungers by the pool tomorrow? Is this the end of a 17-year friendship? And they just almost looked at me as if I was mad and kind of said, well, of course we can. And I hope that raising the volume on friendship, both with the people who we agree with but also disagree with, I hope we can get to a point in our society, and I hope we as Christians can model something in our kindness but also our willingness to be friends and grow relationships. Someone, when I was investigating the friendship thing, someone talked about a really, really helpful image. I think primarily talking actually about, this is for church leaders who disagree on stuff, but they were saying actually the stronger the bridge between two people, the heavier load that can be driven across it. And sometimes we are dealing with what feels like very heavy loads politically and socially and culturally in our world today. But if we've got good relationships and good friendships and we love each other regardless, that I think that can win in the end. If not, that's really difficult. And let's be upfront about the pain and if our friends had turned around and said, actually, no, we can't, that would have been immensely painful. And sometimes that happens. But I hope that we can have brave and kind friendships. And I hope that's the vehicle we talk about.
And I guess on the other side of it, being an evangelical and evangelicals having a particular view, not just on that topic, but other difficult topics. I mean, for example, assisted dying, also called assisted suicide, currently making its way through Parliament. Every evangelical group I can think of would be opposing that. You know, these are tricky issues in society. I've heard some people argue, well, we've got a problem on the other side of things where Christians are no longer willing to stand up and be brave and argue back against the culture. And they're just taking the easy option, whether it be with their friends or politically. Like, do you think that's happening? Do you think Christians are, for want of a better term, going a bit soft on some of these issues at times?
I don't know, Sam, to be honest, in terms of the whole Christian population. I guess I move in circles, especially at the Evangelical Alliance, where we have some very brave people who will be in Parliament probably today talking about some of these issues. So I see less, I guess, the kind of softness. And I think some people have different callings in those areas as well. I hope as people read the chapters in the book, whether it's bravery and kindness, whether it's realism and hope, whether it's diversity and unity, where people, I hope that that there's both an encouragement to people as they read it and go, do you know what, I'm quite kind or I'm quite brave. But I hope there's also a real challenge as well, because when we hold these things in tension, inevitably we fall one side or the other, you know, a bit like you asked me with the, are you 95%, 5% or whatever. Actually, I hope some people will read this and realise, actually, I could be a bit braver. I've been a bit on the back foot when it's come to conversations around this. I could have a true view of scripture and say, actually, I'm really keen to talk about that.
And how much of this is a willingness to kind of agree to disagree? Now, how much this is as an evangelical thinking, look, we can have different views on this subject and it's fine. You know, how do you discern the line? Because there might be issues we think, actually, we can't just have different opinions. We need to stand for the truth. Is that ever a bit of a battle?
I guess it depends on some of the issues we're talking about. And so what was a complete joy for Gavin and I last week is we had the book launch at our Evangelical Alliance Council. And as part of that book launch, we had a few of the people who've endorsed the book who come, as you've seen, from across the whole breadth of the evangelical spectrum. So we had on the stage on this panel, it was deliberately broad. We had John Stevens, who leads the FIEC. We had Ness Wilson, who leads Pioneer. We had Mark Pugh, who leads Elim Churches. We had Yinka Oyakan, who's Evangelical Baptist. And we had Samuel Quaver, who leads the Spanish Church in the UK. And those people would disagree probably on all kinds of issues, women in leadership, gifts of the Spirit, style of worship. There'd be a huge range of on lots of those things. And yet they are, first of all, they're friends. So they're the great relationships between them. But also they're all on a stage saying, we are good news people. We are evangelicals. And there's what we agree on is far more important than what we disagree on. And I hope that one of the things that as people read the book, they go, I'm so proud to say I'm those four things, Bible believing, Jesus centered, conversion seeking, activist inspired follower of Jesus. And there may be some things I disagree with my fellow brothers and sisters, but actually these things unite us far more than they divide us.
In the book, you talk about how people are becoming Christians, which is always a really fascinating area to look at. And you go into detail, but we've spoken about friendship. You talk a bit about mercy ministries. You've mentioned things like food banks and street pastors, that when the church is out there showing the love of Jesus, people often come to faith. There's a whole category around the Bible. There's been some incredible stories of people just by themselves reading scripture and becoming a Christian almost without anyone else having to intervene in any way. Digital being a huge area. And then also kind of miraculous dreams as a fascinating character, where again, God just seems to be supernaturally breaking into people's lives. I thought it was interesting to read that section of the book and think about where should busy churches put their time and attention, almost pragmatically thinking, well, where are those moments where God seems to be reaching people? Let's put more resources into those areas. Well, I'd love to know what your reaction was as you did the research around this. Were there any surprises when you think, oh, wow, people are becoming a Christian in this way? This is an area we need to think more about.
Yeah, one of the most fascinating questions we asked people who'd become Christians, what prompted you to begin exploring the Christian faith? And there were three broad categories which I'd encourage churches to invest their energies in. So the first one was, at the top, there was this cluster at the top where people said, the top answer was, I needed help with life. I was searching for meaning. I'd had a painful or difficult experience. And when we asked our participants, what did they do next? Often, while they were struggling with life, they went to church in some form or another. So a food bank or a toddler group, or their kids went to the youth group or the children's work. What I would encourage us to do is think about how we connect those ministries to faith sharing, because as the Evangelical Alliance, we did some research where we asked our churches, how well connected are your compassion ministries and faith sharing? And just 25% said they had a really cohesive strategy where they were really well connected. My suspicion is if we took that 25% to 95%, we would see hundreds of thousands more people become Christians. If every single person who came to a food bank in the UK today was invited to church on Sunday or Alpha or Christianity Explored, lots more of those people would come to faith in Jesus. That's what the data's saying. Second category is around impact of on a Christian they knew and a Christian talking about their faith. So the more we can do to equip and inspire our those in our churches to be able to share their faith and invite and live in a way that draws people to Jesus, we will see more people come to faith. And then the third category, which ran throughout the whole research, which we talk about in the book and you've just mentioned, is this spiritual experience piece. So we are hearing stories more than I can ever recall of people having dreams, visions, inexplicably being drawn into church. I think we need to be ready for that on a Sunday morning. So I heard recently the story, a fabulous story of a guy who woke up on New Year's Day and said, my New Year's resolution is to find out about Jesus. So he types into ChatGPT, what shall I do? ChatGPT says, where do you live? He tells ChatGPT where he lives. ChatGPT says, go to this church. Here's what time it starts. Here's what number bus to get there. Here's what you can expect. This guy turns up to church. The second week he's there, he gives his life to Jesus and he got baptized at Easter. I think we need to be ready for people having those kind of experiences. And those three things, join up compassion ministry and faith sharing, equip and inspire members to share faith and be ready for people having spiritual experiences. I think if we did that, we'd see more people come to know Jesus.
I'd love to go back to that topic you and I both mentioned of you traveling, I think most weeks, to a different church and sharing. And I just think that gives you and Gavin a very unique perspective on the church in the UK. I'm quite envious, if I'm honest, Phil, because my job is to represent the... yeah, maybe just do a job swap or something. But, you know, my job as editor of the magazine is to try and represent the breadth of and diversity of the UK church, which would include, obviously, the evangelical church and all of its diversity and glory. And so I'm asking purely for selfish reasons, but just give me a bit of an insight into what you're seeing. You're in a different kind of church most weeks. You're in a different part of the country most weeks. What's encouraging you? What's concerning you?
The church is alive, Sam. That's the first thing. I think one of the reasons we've written this book is to kind of almost like take people by the hand and give them a bit, try to paint with our words a front row seat of what it's like to visit the breadth of the UK church. And Gav and I this year will speak in churches of tens and churches of thousands. Sometimes we're the only white person in the room, sometimes only white people in the room, rural, urban, rich, poor, every possible denomination. Sometimes we're translated into Spanish or Urdu or Romanian or Portuguese. It's extraordinary what we see. And the first thing to say is just wherever we go, there is life. The people of God, in whatever style of worship, that I think there's been a dramatic decrease in nominalism. People go in just because they've got a Christian identity and this kind of the thing you do on a Sunday. What's left is a remnant of people who are absolutely on fire for Jesus. I think that's the first thing. Second thing is lots of new Christians. I meet a lot of people who say, I've become a Christian really recently. I asked them to tell me the story. That feeds the kind of the big picture of seeing what God's doing across the UK. And the third thing I say is there are some amazing, extraordinary church leaders out there. One of my great joys is sitting down and hearing people's stories and the commitment, the passion, the gifting, the care. I think it's really difficult to be a leader at the moment, but the quality and the heart of the church leaders across the UK that I encounter is so encouraging. So yes, I think those are my encouragements. And to be honest, I've not got many concerns. I would say where churches are biblical foundations, where they're missionally hearted and where they're creative in approach, there is almost always growth. And so I leave far more, as I did yesterday, driving back up the M40, my heart was full of what I'd seen God do in the morning, and that's always the case.
It's a very encouraging picture, and reminds me of part of the book where you talk about being both realistic and hopeful. I do wonder sometimes if we need to be more hopeful. The reason I say that is, working in Christian journalism, we get press released quite a lot of bad news stories, let's be honest. And I think in the 10 years I've been working here at Premier, there's been a lot of really negative research around church decline, And then suddenly we had this moment with the Quiet Revival where Bible Society bring out the research, which you jokingly said confirmed everything you and Gavin have been seeing as you toured around. And people have, I think, quite understandably really got behind this research because, frankly, I think a lot of Christians were desperate for a bit of good news. And not to say there was no good news happening for the Quiet Revival. Of course there was. But it just gave everyone a piece of research to say this is something to get behind, to be hopeful about. And now everywhere I go, people can't stop talking about the Quiet Revival. Has that been your experience as well? There is a sense of renewed hope, partly as a result of that research, and maybe things like your book as well, that evangelicals and Christians are ready to be hopeful again, to kind of open their eyes to the good news stories as well, and not just believe all the often secular press about church decline.
Yeah, I hope so. And I think actually the Quiet Revival, even more encouragingly, was one of a number of different marker points. So you've got the One Poll study in January. You've got the Times reporting there's an increase in Bible sales. You've got Savanta Comrades talking about the fact that 29% of all students read the Bible at least weekly. So I think it's one of many marker points. And I agree with you, Sam. I think the last few years, the mood amongst leaders has been a mixed bag. And so there have been lots of tired leaders coming out of COVID. But I was at a Christian festival this year and happened to be in the lunch queue behind the person who was leading the leaders' lounge. And I said to them, what's the mood like this year? And they said, you know, in previous years, it's been tired, discouraged leaders. This year, it's absolutely buzzing. And I think that's hopefully a sign of the times of these incredible leaders who've had a slog and all the discomfort and going online and discouragement of COVID-19. We're now in a new season. And I think the Lord relates to us differently in different seasons. In our own personal walk with Jesus, we have winter seasons and then summer seasons. And that's why the stuff we've done around being realistic and hopeful, I hope, is timely because we need to be real as well. And the challenge with Gavin and I is people perceive that we don't have any problems and life's always positive. And we are hopeful. You know, the glass is half full for us. But in that chapter, we also talk about the death of my mum and the pain of 2020. Gav talks about the death of one of his close friends, and we're real. And when you know us, when you get to know us, hopefully you realize actually our skin is not as thick as some people paint it to be. And we do have very real struggles in our life. But the biblical paradigm for that chapter is 2 Corinthians 4. We have this treasure in jars of clay. We are fragile, broken, fractured jars, but the treasure of Jesus makes it all worth it. And that gives us that gospel hope that we need to have now, but also can look forward with great expectation too.
Absolutely. Well, Phil Knox, it's been a pleasure to talk about the new book. It's called Good News People, written in collaboration with Gavin Calver, published by IVP and available everywhere now. Phil's other books on the topic of friendship in particular, also published by IVP. Thank you so much for joining me on the show. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks, Sam. It's been great.
You've been listening to The Profile in association with Premier Christianity Magazine.